You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. It's Monday, May 23rd, 2011, and today on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview with Kathy Ostlier, Canadian author, most recently of the young adult novel written all in verse, by the name of Karma. Kathy Ostlier was born in Manitoba. She and her three siblings grew up as Air Force brats, moving between Manitoba and Ontario military bases. Her family eventually settled in Winnipeg, home to her Ukrainian grandparents. And Kathy there completed high school and a degree in English at the University of Manitoba. After graduation, she worked in Toronto for Warner Publisher Services. And then in 1983, she began a journey that would take her through 16 countries in 18 months. A chance encounter with a sailing crew allowed her to visit 13 of the Greek islands and cruise the coastline of Turkey. In 1984, she continued traveling, going east to India, Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, and the South Pacific. Upon her return to Canada in 1985, she settled in Calgary. Over the next 10 years, she was an at-home parent for three children. She was also a freelance writer. And then in 1990, she took her first creative writing class. Kathy Ostlier's first book, Lost, began as a series of poems, but grew into creative nonfiction essays and ultimately became her memoir. Essays excerpted from Lost have been shortlisted for the National Magazine Awards, Western Magazine Awards, CBC Literary Awards, and Prism International and Event Magazine nonfiction contests. In 2009, Lost, a memoir, was shortlisted for the prestigious Edna Stabler Award for Creative Nonfiction. In 2010, Kathy Ostlier co-wrote with Dennis Carnhume, Artistic Director of Theatre Calgary, Lost, a memoir, a 90-minute one-woman play performed in Calgary and expected to tour Canada over the next 2 years. Her first novel, Karma, is written in verse, as I mentioned a minute ago. It's for young adults and was released by Penguin in Canada and the U.S. in March. When I spoke to Kathy earlier this month, I asked her to talk about how she began her writing career, which actually pretty much started when she was already an adult.
Well, I do have a degree in English, so, you know, I guess in my mind there was always that chance that I might want to write something. I think all people with degrees in English think they might write something one day. And yeah. So I kept journals and traveled a lot and wrote, but never anything very serious. And then when my second child was born and he was 5 months old, I decided to take a writing class at a local writing center. And so I started doing that, and I just wrote pieces, but never really finished anything, never sent anything out, and was working on some stuff when in 1995 my brother David went missing.
Right.
And so a number of years after that, I decided to take some of that, I guess I would call it grief writing, and worked on it as poetry and then worked on it as essays and eventually decided to put it together and make it into a full-length manuscript.
Okay, all right. You've written a memoir, and you've also written this new book, Karma, that's a book in verse that's mostly, I guess, being marketed toward young adults. So I'm interested in these different genres, how you decided to move into the genre you moved into after your memoir Lost.
It was kind of accidental, and probably, you know, I think maybe a lot of writers might say that. Lost was a very grueling process for me, and so when I was finished, or just before it was going to press, I started looking around for something else to write, and I wanted something I thought would be small, something that wouldn't take as long, something not as exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
So I had been listening to a young adult author who was in Calgary at a WordFest, and he spoke about how if you're looking for story ideas, sometimes you have something in your computer. Maybe you even have an adult novel that didn't quite work and perhaps can be adapted for a young adult story. So I literally went into my computer under the creative writing folder and thought, okay, what's in here? You know, I guess the other idea might be pulling a drawer out. You might have something in a drawer underneath your bed, or just you might have just papers. So I started going through these files to see what was there, and there was a file there called India. And I opened it up, and it was a large, large file, actually, and it ended up being about 30,000 words. But it was written very stream of consciousness, or free-fall writing, writers sometimes call it. And it had no paragraphs and very little punctuation, very little capitalization, and filled with spelling errors. And it just went on and on and on about India. And I had started it the year after I'd returned from India, so that was 1985. Uh-huh. And over the years, I had added to it. And there was a girl in the stuff that I was writing, and her name was Leah. And there was a boy, and they were following him up. And out of that, I saw that there was enough writing, there were enough words there that I thought, maybe I can use this and I can write a young adult novel and it'll be short, take 6 months, and I'll be done with it. So
that sounds like a little optimistic.
Well, it was incredibly naive, but yeah, that's what I thought. So when I started lifting sections of this this writing off, I was just pulling off images and some character stuff, and just pulling things off, actually, that I liked. And I just threw it into another file, and when I threw it in, it was landing really like poetry, because it was just line after line after line after line. And that's when I looked at it, and I thought, this could be perhaps a verse novel. And that's, it's quite a large genre in the States and in Australia, not in Canada at all, actually, but I've read many, many American verse novels. And so that's how it started. Okay. And then it was going to be about a girl, and he's going to fall in love with a boy. But then I needed some dramatic incidents. I needed something to really happen. And that's when I decided to set it in 1984, which is when I was in Asia, during the time that Indira Gandhi is murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And the riots that ensued in Delhi, and that this girl finds herself, she's a Canadian girl, finds herself alone in Delhi in the middle of the riots, and what's going to happen after that.
Now, it sounds like you started this as a way to kind of give yourself a little bit of a relief in your writing from some really heavy stuff you'd been working on before. Did this end up becoming a really heavy thing as well because of the change of tone?
Oh, dear. Well, Yeah. It's a serious story, and it is based on real events. So the research I've done, the events are real, but the story is fictional, and the characters are fictional. So working in fiction was much lighter than writing about myself and my brother and my family. So in that way, it was a much easier go of it. But as I went deeper and deeper into the story, and the book started to expand, and now it's 528 pages. So my initial thought of a 200-page verse novel in 6 months grew into 3 years, 528 pages. And the editors at Penguin saying, no, keep going. You know, they didn't give me any kind of limits at all, which is actually, I think, maybe kind of unusual for writers.
I would think so.
Yeah, so, I mean, I could have kept on going, but eventually I did have to, you know, I had to finish the thing. So,
yeah, right.
But it's a serious story, and I got drawn more and more into the suffering that had happened during this time, and that made the novel heavy,
okay,
and difficult in a new way and much different than my memoir.
Yeah. Well, we have mentioned your memoir, so let's talk about that a little bit. It's called Lost, and the book recounts the story of your brother David's disappearance at sea, along with his girlfriend Sarah, and your search to find out what might have happened to them. When did you start writing the book?
When David and Sarah went missing, I was keeping a journal, so I could keep track of who I had been speaking to and what we had been speaking about. And by that, I mean the Coast Guard in England, as well as other Coast Guards along the Atlantic, the European Atlantic seaboard, and the Canadian embassy in Portugal as well. So I was keeping notes. And then the year after, when I went to Ireland and I went to Madeira as well, and then I went to Scotland. I again kept notes, so I had some things written down. And then, but once we finally did acknowledge that they weren't coming back, I started to write poetry. and had lots of that, and then found that in poetry, which is an excellent vehicle for expressing deep emotion, I found I wanted to actually say more about what had happened. Mm-hmm. So I started to write essays. So the essays probably began, maybe 3 years after, so probably, 1998.
Okay.
So it's like a 10-year process because the book came out in 2008.
Mm. He and Sarah were making a journey. Maybe you can just sort of tell us where they were supposed to be going, and then when you lost contact with them.
Okay, they were living in the south of England with their small sailboat, and in the spring of 1995, they actually sailed up the west coast of Ireland to the Isle of Mull in Scotland, which is where they had been living before they had decided they wanted to buy a boat and live close to the ocean. So they sailed up there, and that's where Sarah's mother was living, and they had lots and lots of friends, so they stayed there for about a month or so, and then sailed back down the west coast of Ireland, and the plan was for them to leave Ireland and sail to the island of Madeira, and they were going to sail there via the Azores Islands. So that was the routing as far as everybody knew. And I had spoken to my brother in July, and he said he was leaving in a few weeks. So, in fact, I expected, I think, sort of all of August to get a call or a letter or something saying that he and Sarah had arrived in Madeira. But to be honest, I wasn't paying a lot of attention. I mean, there wasn't internet then. So the only way to talk to people was by the phone and or mail, and we've been used to not being able to hear from him for a while because mm-hmm. he traveled a lot. So there were no warning bells going off, and I wasn't really paying attention. I was basically a mom at home with three small kids, and that was really taking up most of my brain space, I guess.
Yeah. The book is an amalgam, really, of memories and journal entries and letters and conversations, and then some imagined narrative as well, imagined conversations. How did you find the right structure for Lost?
I think that the structure of any book is often the most challenging thing for a writer. And for myself in particular, I think the way that I write is very much like a patchwork quilt, and I have done quilting, mm-hmm. so I understand that process. But when I was writing Lost, and even when I was writing Karma, I would literally have scenes or memories in Lost, scenes, memories, all these things, and there would be so much to say and so much I wanted to tell. And I in the book I go back in memory a lot. And all I did was I kept pasting them in, and that's the beauty of the computer, of course. I just kept pasting them in, and I would look at them, and I would read it out loud, and how did it sound?
Right.
But by the end, I mean, there's a very strong chronological narrative line in Lost. Mm-hmm. It does start in September, and it goes really for a full year. But in along that line are hung many, many memories and many scenes and some imaginative scenes as well. So in some ways it's like a clothesline, mm-hmm. and I hung all these on it. And sometimes I think I could take any one of those memories or scenes and shuffle them all around, and it maybe wouldn't even matter too much. Mm. So eventually that just became the structure, very, 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 very loose structure, the strong narrative line, this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And then in between, all these other things are happening in my mind, in my emotional life, in my memories, and in my imagination.
Yeah. And in your marriage, too, at the same time that this was all going on, you and your husband were coping with his diagnosis of cancer. You wrote this one line that really struck me in the book. This cancer felt like a warning, a small voice reminding us that there is something we have forgotten, something we were supposed to do with our lives. And I thought that was such a strong statement, both about, you know, David and about your situation with your family and with your husband's health.
Yeah. People who have traumatic events often do feel that, like, what are they going to do now? I mean, they're just reminded of how fragile life really is. And at any moment, anything really fantastic can happen to you, and something equally traumatic can happen as well. And you don't know, and life is, to me, just one big surprise. And so I guess I feel still, after all this time, that it's very, very important to live the life you want and live it as fully as possibly and live it as authentic as you can. And for my brother, that meant living on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for him, that was the authentic life. He wanted to experience total freedom. And I think sailing on the ocean is an example of that,
mm-hmm.
Where you and the boat depend upon each other to survive, and you are at the whim of nature. So for him, that was the ultimate expression of freedom and who he was. For other people, it's very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
But I still believe that we need to, that we should be living our lives like that. And cancer is one of those warnings or reminders.
Yeah, and even if everybody isn't comfortable living on the edge by sailing or by rock climbing or whatever, you know, there are ways that we can find to treat ourselves to freedom if that's what we crave. And it is important to remember that. I felt in reading that sentence that really struck me, that everybody could relate to this, even if they're not, you know, living on the edge types of people.
Mm-hmm.
Lost was also made into a play, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that happened.
Well, that's kind of a neat story. The book came out in May of 2008, and I think it was June 2008 that the artistic director of Theatre Calgary was in Vancouver, and he was at a bookstore in the travel section, which is where he likes to go because he's a great traveler himself, and Lost was strangely shelved there. I wouldn't call it a travel book.
No.
But
no, that's really odd.
It has a lot of travel in it, so I guess someone thought, well, it should go here. And so he picked it up because he was attracted to the cover, which is of a seascape and clouds. And he just flipped open the front cover, and he saw it was written by a Calgarian. And he thought, oh, I'm always looking for Calgary stories to tell. So he just bought it, and he took it home. And he has a cabin in Ontario, and he started to read it. And he said he was about halfway through, and he said, this is a play.
Oh, wow.
So he sent me an email, like, 11 o'clock at night, about would I like to turn Lost into a play. And it's a funny story because we laugh about it now, because when the email came through, there were spelling errors in the email. It was very, very short. And it was, I had to Google the guy. I didn't say, who is this guy, right? I mean, I live in Calgary, but I just didn't know his name. And so it was a very serious offer. It wasn't from some community, you know, that wanted to just put on a play or something. So
yeah.
So we talked about it, and I was shocked, incredibly shocked by that it could even happen like that, but also the shocked with the idea of having my story up on stage. But I found I couldn't say no for a couple of reasons. One, it would be certainly a writer's dream come true to have your book turned into a play.
Yeah.
But also I found myself very, very curious, and it felt like a risky thing to do. So it was as risky to me as my brother taking his boat off into the ocean. This was very, very risky.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea what was going to happen to it. And we wouldn't know really until the end. So once I agreed to it, we were into the process of it. And I said yes, because I thought, if my brother has, you know, the situation didn't teach me anything, it taught me that you need to say yes more than no in life, and even when it's really, really scary. So we worked on that play for about 18 months, workshopping it with the actress, and it went on stage last October to the theater's a large 750-seat theater. Played for almost 3 weeks, and it was amazing.
And
it's stunning.
It's a one-woman play, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, so it's all about your journey as, I mean, it's about David's story, but through her or your eyes and discovery and journey.
Yes. Mm. Yes. And what the actress, how we wrote the play eventually was, is that the woman on stage is talking to her brother.
Okay.
So the audience becomes the brother.
Oh. Now you said the play is coming east this summer, is that right?
Actually, it is coming to Halifax in October.
Oh, in October.
In October for a 3-week run. Then it's going to Winnipeg, my hometown, in January for a 3-week run. But we've also had interest from an American repertory theater as well in the Midwest.
Oh, wow.
Who's interested in staging it, but not with the actors in the sets. It would just be a woman on stage with a chair.
Mm.
So they would just buy the play, and then they would do it their way. So that has now become my new scary thing. Is I got very used to Jan Alexander Smith, who plays Kathy on the stage, and I got used to what we had written, and I was good with it. But now to think you're going to give it to someone who doesn't know me, doesn't know my story, doesn't know anything, and of course it's. I've written the words for the play, but it can be staged in many ways, and the tone of it can be changed depending on the director. And it's just an odd thing, all of a sudden, to again now have to give this play away to complete strangers.
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel a sense of ownership each time because it comes originally from your work? You must.
Well, yes, and it's me.
Right. Yeah.
It isn't me. I mean, over the time, I was able to really separate Jan from myself. And I do refer to the woman on stage as Kathy, not as me. But they are my words. It is my life.
Mm-hmm.
These are my experiences. And all of my fears and all my vulnerabilities are up there on stage for others to see.
Yeah.
Which doesn't bother me nearly as much as when I have to see it. Because then I have to look at myself in a new way. And the upside of it has been actually terrific. I mean, when you write a memoir, a lot of people ask me, was this cathartic for you? Did you let the ghosts go? Do you feel better? And I didn't feel good at all while I was writing this. Mm. I felt good when it was done. But I was still so inside my words and so inside the private work that it is to write a book.
Right.
You are in a room, you're by yourself, no one's with you. And then it's done. But with a play, it's up on stage, and you're really, really separate. So the words are mine, and the moving around is mine, or the action is mine. But it's not me up there. So I found I was able to look at myself in a new way.
Hmm.
And in the book, I am very vulnerable, and I don't always like who I am. I don't like my feelings all the time that I have in this book. I don't. And I found when I watched the actress play me on stage, I liked her.
Which would be a huge relief.
It was a huge relief. Because you imagine if you're watching this character going, oh my God,
right.
She is so this or so that. But no, I really liked her.
Yeah.
And that gave me a great feeling.
Yeah,
this very long process was the correct thing to do.
And there must be so many layers of that because, first of all, it's will you like your own words in this forum? And then will you like the character that you created that became Kathy? But then there's do you like the way this actress acts in the first place or her voice? And then there's how she acts as Kathy. I mean, there's just so many layers it would be.
Yeah, there is. And she's not like me. I mean, physically, she's different. She's one of the big differences between the voice in the book and the voice on stage is the voice on stage is much more powerful and much more dramatic.
Mm.
And it has to be because it's a theater.
Yeah, yeah.
So the tone of the book is much more self-reflective. It's much quieter. It's more poetic. But what's on stage is much bolder.
Yeah.
And there are times when the actress is on stage and she's shouting and she's yelling and her movements are very large and she scared me the first time I saw her. She really did. I thought, oh, my God, she's so scary, right? But when I looked at her, I thought, oh, God, I wish I was more like that.
Yeah.
Like I wanted to be like the actress who was playing me. And so that's interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I want it to come to Montreal because that would be close by here.
Yes, I know. Maybe. I mean, after this year, maybe you'll get picked up again.
That would be great. Well, let's talk a little more about karma, because that is your latest project. You did start to describe it a little bit earlier, but I wonder if you can describe the book, apart from your own travels and the genesis of its creation, just sort of describe the book a little bit.
It's set in 1984, and it is a series of three diaries. The first diary is by a 15-year-old Canadian girl whose father is Sikh and whose mother is Hindu, and they live in a small town in Manitoba, and she was born in Canada. Mm-hmm. In the opening few pages, she's on an airplane flying to India, and they are carrying her mother's ashes because her mother has committed suicide. The mother really just could not fit in to the community life that her husband had brought her to, a small town in Manitoba. She was a stranger. She could not make friends. She had no community, and eventually she just goes crazy and ends up killing herself. So the daughter and the father are bringing the ashes back. So the story begins on an airplane. And when they land in India, within 12 hours, Indira Gandhi is shot by her Sikh bodyguards, and the whole city of Delhi erupts in chaos. And the father and daughter are separated, and Maya finds herself alone in Delhi, and she's frightened, and she doesn't know what to do. So she makes a decision to get on a train. And from that moment on, the rest of the book is Maya is now on her own trying to deal with the trauma, not just of losing her mother, but the trauma of being alone in India. Mm. Some very traumatic events happened to her. So the middle part of the book is another diary, but this time it is written in the voice of a 17-year-old boy named Sandeep. And Maya has ended up living with this family on the edge of the Thar Desert. And Maya, I won't say what happens, but anyway, this becomes... Sandeep starts to tell the story, so we now see Maya through his eyes.
Okay.
And then there's a third diary as well. So.
All right. Have you been back to India since 1984?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I was there about 5 years ago.
Okay. And do you have any plans to go back now that you've written Karma?
I always want to go to India. I really love India. So the book will come out in India.
Oh, it will.
So, maybe there will be an opportunity to do a reading there or something. So then I would definitely go.
Now, is the book being translated into other languages?
Not at this time, no.
Okay. I loved this part. Can I just read a little part of it? It reminded me as well about your brother David and your having written about his loss. This is from Karma. Can the dead really speak through the hand and pen of the living? A mother's voice floats in from the edge of the world. A daughter hears the whispers. Or is it loneliness that conjures the loved one from the ash? No one wants to be forgotten, not the dead or the living. I just loved that. I thought it was very beautiful. And and it did. It reminded me of you having lost your brother David and just people that I've lost and how writing about them does seem to kind of keep them with us. Do you want to talk about that at all? Or?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you've lost someone in your life, that loss is always there. If you're a writer, that loss is going to come out in the work. And in Karma, there are also people, not the main characters, but there are people who go missing in Karma. So that is a theme, certainly, that is carried over from loss as well.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, this is a story about a political situation where there was a great deal of violence and people went missing, and it's really quite a horrible story. And so, the other thing is, in telling this story, I'm telling a piece of history as well. So for all those people who suffered in 1984 during these riots, the stories for them, so that their story can be told too. So there's the individual person who's missing that we want to keep alive, but there's also there's the larger numbers in political tragedy that we want to keep alive as well. We want to remember these stories, these people who were killed, the innocent people who were killed. And so that's important too, as a way of telling what it is to be human. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The cover of the book is beautiful. It's very bright and colorful. I was wondering how they designed the cover and if you had anything to do with it and if you're pleased with it.
Yeah, I had nothing to do with it. I learned something about covers. when Lost came out, they sent me three options, and they asked me, so which one, you know, do you like it? I mean, they were really nice in the email. What do you think? And I really actually thought they wanted my opinion, so I gave it to them. Which I didn't, at the time, did not like the cover, and I just got yelled at pretty much that, hey, it wasn't my book anymore, give it up, we're going to choose the cover. So I learned when some publishers, I'm sure it's not true at all, offer you the cover to go, what do you think? They actually don't really care what you think. They want you to say, I love it.
Yeah. Did they want you to? Did they want you to rank the three options? Is that what they were?
They did.
Yeah,
they did. They asked what they and but I thought they actually cared what I thought. So
right.
I told them.
So you said let's look for something else.
Yeah, I said, oh, how about this instead? You know, and then of course that was just my editor, and of course at the time we were very close, but I got really mad at him because I said, you know, throughout this book you have asked me to be above all honest in the writing of Lost. And I was. I was as honest as I could bear. And so I got pretty ticked off when all of a sudden I wasn't allowed to be honest about the cover.
Mm.
So that it was sort of that kind of issue that I had. But with Karma, when they sent it over to me, they said, you know, what do you think? And I opened up the PDF file, and I couldn't help myself. My whole face just, I could feel myself smiling.
Yeah.
And I loved it immediately. I just thought it was beautiful, and I still do.
Yeah.
And everyone else does, too. It's so nice. You know, I get little emails from people, or I'm on a YA blog, and someone will go, oh, look at the cover. It's so gorgeous, you know. So. And I think it's true that writers are a little too close to the work probably to really offer, you know, really good advice on the cover.
Right, right.
Or even the title. But in this case, I do. I love it.
Oh, that's great. So do you have a section that you could read?
I do. I will read from Maya's diary. It's in the early part of the book. October 29th, 1984. Home. India bubbles like lava. Waves of heat stir the air into water. Black asphalt turns to pitch. The plane lands on the soft gray tarmac and sinks. My father puts his turban on his head. He balances my mother's ashes on his lap. He sighs and whispers, we're home. He's not talking to me. We've arrived. Not yet to Chandigarh, city beautiful, where my mother's sisters weep and wail for the mourning month. Not yet to the golden state of Punjab and its angry air, but New Delhi, city of stink and noise, streets clogged with flesh, voices loud and soft, sounding of despair, smelling of pee. No eat, no eat. Hungry, a one-armed woman pleads with me. Hungry, her invisible hand, rupees, finds my arm, rupees, paws and paws and gives me shivers. Give me rupees, she says. Her eyes are saucers, no eat 1 week. Her skull is a moon, hungry, a white bone, white stone under skin. Hungry, she whispers. Look away, my father says, but I can't. No eat, no eat, her children whimper, no eat, no eat, sing their song of hunger, no eat, no eat, with bellies swollen like party balloons. Look away, you can't help them, he says. The mother bares her breast, a shriveled apple of sustenance. No eat, look away. Rickshaw, rickshaw. Rickshaw, rickshaw, you want rickshaw? No rickshaw, my father says to the small brown man, but he pretends not to hear. Where you go? Where you go? The man's skin is dry, veined, and lined like leather. My rickshaw fast, very, very fast. His body twists and writhes, coils around my father's arm. A good price just for you, returning son of India. My father has brought me to a country where snakes can talk. Where you go? I take you now. Come, come, come. No rickshaw, my father shouts at the man, He shrinks to the ground, hissing. "Good price," he says. "Chai." A hand tugs at my arm, holds up a small earthen cup. "Chai chai?" It belongs to a boy, small, yet his face is old. He could be 9 or 20 or 37. 1 rupee chai. He puts the chai into my hand, presses my fingers around the unbaked clay. "Drink now, chai chai." The tea is brown like a puddle. 1 rupee. And swirling like an eddy. "Chai, rupee, rupee chai." I hear voices rising out of the cup. "Chai," crying, "chai, rupee, rupee." Weeping, "chai, rupee, rupee chai." Like crows plucked alive. "Eat, rupee, rupee, eat. I, hungry, rupee, chai." The air rings with longing and pain. I, rupee." The ground shakes with heartbreak and sorrow. "I, rupee, I, chai." I raise the cup to my lips. I. The tea slides down my throat, and I swallow India. Don't ever leave my side. My father grabs my arm and the cup falls. "Why you drop chai?" It breaks into pieces. "You pay me 1 rupee. The clay shards return to dust. Now you pay me. But I am dragged away before I can pay. "Keep walking and close your ears," says my father. But I cannot close my ears. I. The voices seep in. I. The spilled tea darkening the earth. I. A hungry chorus. "Eat. Swallowing me, eat, until I am one of them. Wanting, I, hungry, needing. We are sick in our wanting and need." "Don't listen," my father shouts above the crowd. "Eat, rupee, chai, chai, eat, rupee." "Don't listen, that's the answer. Don't listen to hunger, don't listen to pain." A bony hand reaches out and claws my father's arm. A woman swings a skinny baby close to his face. A week, no eat a week," she says. He stops. He looks into the mother's eyes. Her tears run flat streams. "Then eat your children," my father says.
Oh, my goodness. And for a teenage girl from Canada to arrive there and see this, I mean, I'm a grown person who's seen quite a bit of the world, but I mean, I haven't been to India, and I just can't imagine. You were an adult when you went there, but I mean,
yeah.
The idea of a teenage girl seeing all this for the first time is really quite striking, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for reading that. That was a really powerful introduction to the book and to the idea that she gets separated from him soon after that. Wow. Let's talk a little bit about writing in general. What's your writing schedule like?
I write every morning. So I get up, have tea. Sometimes, you know, might empty the dishwasher, but often not. And try to sit down and write right away. Right now I'm working on a new novel, so it's a little more relaxed, and I'm actually using my laptop for it, and I'll just sit on the couch, and I'm typing, and in fact, what I'm trying to create is a very large file of some very raw material that I can use for the next book. So I am literally letting my mind go. Whatever I think, I put down. I'm bringing in whatever I'm reading, whatever I'm watching on TV, all my feelings, all my emotions, and certainly probably my personal life as well, is just all being thrown into this file where I will later on mine it for the material that I want to use for the book. So I think I've discovered after this many years that that's my style of doing it. Very much that patchwork quilt again, where you take scenes, you take things, and you start putting them together. And often what things you put beside each other start to resonate or support each other. So I write, or if I'm editing as I was with Karma, I would work probably till about 1 or 1:30. In the afternoon, and then I'm pretty tired by then, and so then I have lunch, and I try to go swimming in the afternoon, or I have other writing projects or other things that I have to do. I will do later in the day. So.
And as far as some of the online marketing that you've had to do recently for Karma, is that afternoon work usually? Except that I made you do this in the morning.
No, since Karma, I haven't been able to do much on the novel because. I've got these other things to do.
Okay.
Like this interview, which I'm thrilled to do, and an online marketing. So I've been very scattered the last little bit. I haven't been able to write quite like I want to.
Mm.
So, I mean, I've been able to get a couple of hours in the morning, and then I will move on to the other stuff. So.
And that, how long until you'll get back to a sort of more normal writing schedule?
Actually, I've got some traveling coming up and stuff, so probably really not till June, I would think.
Mm.
And then it's summer, and then that's hard again because you actually want to be in your house.
Right.
But I do have a goal of a number of pages. They don't have to be good pages. They just have to be pages.
Right.
And the goal was by August to have about 400 pages. I don't think I'm going to meet that goal, but it's out there as a goal. So
yeah. Are you able to talk at all about your next project, or is it too new?
Yeah. I think it's a book written for adults.
Okay.
It'll have, I think, three to four different voices in it.
Okay.
Fiction.
Yep.
And I did vow early in the writing that no one would die in this book, because I didn't want to revisit that, but already it looks like one of them is going to. So maybe not.
You're not very good about sticking to the light side that you assign yourself.
No, you know, and yet I feel as a person I'm quite light, you know. My attitude is light. I mean, I'm out in the world. I'm happy. I'm enthusiastic. I'm curious. But I suppose my nature is melancholic, and certainly the events of my life have made me approach serious topics. And my writing style is poetic, which tends to make it more melancholic as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we'll see, though. I'm hoping in this next novel, because there's different voices, that I will do different voices with different attitudes.
Yeah, right.
So that may allow me to have at least one of them be a little bit lighter.
Right.
In tone.
Okay, great. who are some of your favorite writers, Kathy?
If I look on my bookshelf, I'm in my office right now. There's Ian McEwan, Atonement on Chesil Beach. I just love his writing. I can never put it down once I start.
Yeah.
Marilyn Robinson,
yep.
Who's an amazing, beautiful, deep writer. I love her books. She doesn't do that many because she does them so well, I guess. Toni Morrison, of course. Rohit Mistry, who wrote A Fine Balance. Now, he's a Canadian writer, and it's... that book is set in India. It's just an incredible book.
Yeah, yeah.
I love Anne Michaels, another Canadian writer. Just sort of looking at my shelf here. Who else is up here that I just adore? Aaron Appelfeld is an Israeli writer who I really, really like as well. So those are my favorites.
And are you reading anything right now, or are you too busy with all of this stuff that you're not able to...
Well, I am too busy with all this stuff, but I have a book club, and, you know, when you belong to a book club, you're supposed to read the books.
Right.
Which doesn't always happen, and now all women in book clubs know that, right? Because sometimes you don't like it, or sometimes you don't have time, or whatever. But our book club this week, actually tonight, chose two books, and one is called Tweak, which is a true life memoir by Nick Schaff. About his struggles with addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And the other book is written by his father, David Schaff, called Beautiful Boy.
Oh, you're reading?
And it's written from the father's perspective on what it's like to have a son who is addicted to crystal meth. And to read them both together is, well, they're both so... so powerful, both incredible writers. And I just finished Beautiful Boy last night and just was so deeply moved by this man's honesty. He just opened up his life and his heart and all his experiences onto what it was like. It's an incredible book. Both books are incredible, and I don't know where Nick Schaff is right now in his life, whether he's managed to beat this addiction or not, but I sure hope so, because he's an admirable man as well.
Yeah. Right.
That's what I've been doing.
That's a really interesting project, to read the two books together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Kathy, I have one last question for you. Mm-hmm. Writers sort of always get the message, or I mean, maybe not always, but more and more it seems like writers are discouraged from being different in their work, and that the big bestsellers are so often sort of formulaic. And yet in your case, you know, you've written a couple of books that I think are very unique and very much your own style, you know, and in particular Karma, it being written in verse for a young adult audience after you wrote a memoir that was probably mostly for an adult audience. So I'm wondering if you have any advice for writers who work on something that's a little bit outside the box.
I guess I do have advice. With Karma, unlike Lost got shown to a lot of people because I didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. It was my first book. I hadn't published anything. How does one write a book? How does one structure it? What do you do? So I showed it to a lot of people, took courses with it, mostly just got very muddled with the whole thing because everyone, of course, had different ideas, and because it was such a deeply personal work, some people didn't want to say anything at all. Mm-hmm. So with Karma, when I started it, and it started when I realized it was going to be verse, I showed it to no one. So Karma was read by no one until I shared it with my agent, and I said, "This is what I'm working on. What do you think?" I was about halfway through, and I said, "Do you think I should keep going, or should I just abandon it now because no one's going to buy this?" And he said, "Well, I like it." He said, "But I don't know." He said, "Do you want me to try and sell it?" And I said, yes, see if you can sell it. And then it was sold, and Penguin picked it up.
And they picked it up before you'd finished it.
And they picked it up before I finished it, which is highly unusual as well, certainly. But for me, the strength came from being committed to the way I wanted to tell the story I wanted to tell, which was fairly risky because I'm neither Sikh nor Hindu. So I'm out of that cultural group, and yet I've told this story. Mm-hmm. About a political situation that I had no part of. And I stayed very committed to my character. So after a while, I realized this was Maya's story, and Maya needed to tell this story in any way she needed to tell it. And I had to protect it from other people, because I knew if I sent this out to some friends, and they're all wonderful writers and wonderful readers, they were all going to have their own opinions, and I was really afraid I was going to lose my drive for it and lose Maya's voice. Mm. So I think my advice would be, if someone's working on the edge, is to stick with it, don't show it to anybody, and just believe in yourself and believe in your characters.
Great.
And hopefully then you get an editor who likes your work or likes the edge of your work. So
wonderful advice. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for talking with me, and best of luck with Karma.
Oh, thank you so much. I've enjoyed this.
And I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Kathy Ostlier. You can learn more about her work at kathy-ostlier.com. And that's Kathy-Ostlier, Ostlere.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the work of my guest, Kathy Ostlier, whose new novel, Karma, is written in verse, as you heard us discuss. Here is the prompt for this week. Look through your creative writing file on the computer or in the bottom of your desk drawer. Pull out an idea that you have previously shelved, maybe because you thought it wouldn't amount to anything. And then have another look at it. And consider what might happen if you were to develop a certain character whose life or situation might be relevant to this idea by working it in verse. You can try rhyming verse or simply playing with rhythms. See if something new comes out of that idea simply because you're working with words in a different way. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. You can also send writing prompts to that same email, writethebook@gmail.com. And I will happily credit you for any prompts that you might share with the listening audience. Cheryl Willoughby is going to be here with the World of Music at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator Community Radio, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.